Hey there, I'm Stephen Dubner, and this is our new season of Freakonomics Radio. We'll be here every week on the station telling you things you always thought you knew but didn't, and things you never thought you wanted to know but do. This week, what happens when thousands of doctors from all over the country leave their hometowns for a medical conference? Also, what's the most efficient form of exercise? I'll give you a hint, it is not listening to your radio. But for the next hour, at least, I am personally giving you a doctor's note to let you do just that. Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we met Anupam Jaina.
I'm an assistant professor of healthcare policy and medicine at Harvard Medical School. I'm a physician and an economist. I spend about 80% of my time doing healthcare economics and health policy research.
Jaina and some colleagues analyzed Medicare data to see how heart patients do when cardiologists are away at professional conferences. Jaina knew the related literature, studies, for instance, looking into whether patients get worse care if they're admitted to hospitals late at night or on weekends when there are fewer or less experienced staff on duty.
And the answer in most studies has actually been yes. Not all, but most studies find that patients receive...
That you have worse outcomes, yes?
Exactly. Worse outcomes if you're hospitalized during off hours.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a natural stepping stone to say, well, what happens if you're a patient and you happen to be hospitalized with a really acute condition when cardiologists are out of town at a national meeting?
So Jaina and his co-authors, Vinay Prasad, Dana Goldman, and John Romley, wondered what they'd find when it came to cardiology meetings. They narrowed their analysis to the patients who were in really bad shape.
The idea is we want to pick conditions where a patient doesn't choose to not come to the hospital because their particular doctor is away or because they have some knowledge that cardiologists are away during this time. High-risk heart failure. What we found is that if you're hospitalized on a cardiology meeting date, your mortality is about 17% at 30 days, 17 to 18%. Whereas if you're hospitalized just a few days before or a few days after, your mortality is closer to 25%. So that's a very large difference.
Wow. It just sounds so absurd. I mean, I've read the paper. I know what you're going to say, but it still sounds so absurd. So basically, if I have a major heart condition and someone gets me to a good teaching hospital, I live in New York. My hospital is Columbia Presbyterian. That's a great teaching hospital. You're saying that I have a better chance of surviving if there's a cardiology conference going on and some of the top cardiologists are not there.
That's correct.
Oof. Okay. And describe for me overall the magnitude of this effect compared to, let's say, you know, standard cardiology treatment, whether it's beta blockers or statins, angioplasty, stents. How much better off are you by having those interventions than you are by just simply going to the hospital when the cardiologists are not there?
So just to give you a sense, the mainstays of treatment for heart disease are beta blockers, statins, aspirin, for some individuals, a blood thinner like Plavix. If you were to combine all those therapies together, we're probably talking about reducing your mortality by about 2 to 3 percentage points.
Wow, percentage points, okay. And here you're talking about 8 percentage points in one case and 10 percentage points in another.
Exactly. So these treatments are very effective, but they're not nearly as large in magnitude as what we're finding.
Another finding in Jaina's paper, patients received far fewer invasive treatments, stents and angioplasties, for instance, when the cardiologists were away.
So an angioplasty is a procedure in which a balloon is inflated in one of the arteries that supply the heart. It basically opens up the blood vessel that was clogged. That is different than stenting. Stenting is a procedure in which an actual stent is placed in the heart and opens up the artery, and it keeps the artery open. There's nearly a third reduction in rates of angioplasty / stenting during meeting days. And remember, in heart attacks, we didn't find any difference in mortality. And so at the very least, what this would suggest is that, look, we're able to reduce these procedures by about a third, and yet we see no difference in mortality in heart attacks.
What does the empirical research say about the efficacy of, say, angioplasty? In other words, we hear about these invasive treatments, angioplasty and stenting and so on, and we, the public, like to think that if doctors have gone to the trouble and researchers have gone to the trouble to come up with these things, of course they work really well. Not only to come up with these things, but to use these things and to build for these things and so on. But talk to me for a moment about what we actually know or maybe don't know about the efficacy of such interventions.
These interventions, for example, stenting or angioplasty, are extraordinarily effective. I think if you look at the interventions that have been developed in the last 30 years for heart disease, they rank at the highest in terms of their innovativeness and their effectiveness. And most of the patients for whom these interventions have been studied have been what I would characterize as average to moderate risk patients. There have been some studies with very severe coronary artery disease, very sick patients for whom these interventions have been studied. And even in those studies, they do find average benefits for these procedures. So by and large, I think if you were to look at this study without any information about the results, you would think to yourself, by lowering rates of these invasive procedures, we are likely to harm patients.
You would think that. And so would, presumably, the doctors we spoke with at a cardiology conference in San Diego.
You should think the opposite, right? You should think the less doctors, the more dies, right? But it's interesting.
Well, we would have to look at the methods of the study to see how robust it is.
It just doesn't make sense to me that less access to a physician or less access to medical care would make things better.
Most of these doctors hadn't heard about Jane's study. We'll talk more about why it is that news travels so slowly in medicine. And while we're on the subject of healthcare, we ask a very basic question. What's the best exercise?
The right way to think about this is, it's the wrong question. And, you know, if I've learned anything in my life, whenever I ask the wrong question, it almost guarantees I will not find the right answer.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Anupam Jaina admits that his study can't really pinpoint a cause for its surprising findings.
The strongest limitation of the paper is that we can't tell you exactly what's going on. So what I can tell you with as close to certainty is that something is happening in the hospitals that is responsible for the lower mortality on meeting days.
And keep in mind, it's not as if there are no cardiologists in hospitals during annual meetings. Some docs cover for others. More junior staff might take over for a few days. Jaina suspects that the doctors who stay behind may be more cautious.
What we're identifying is that group of patients for whom the cardiologists who were left behind may have thought to themselves, this person may not be appropriate for this procedure. And the clinical decisions that they're making are different now. And they could be different in a way that actually improves outcomes because they're restricting procedures for those who are at the margin, who would be least likely to benefit.
And your explanation would be that these are docs who are covering, who might be more junior or whatnot, and they are less likely to order up what a more senior, confident, experienced doctor might order up? Is that one explanation?
That's one explanation. Another explanation could be that the covering doctor says to himself or herself, look, I don't want to do this thing because I'd be better off not harming the patient by doing the procedure. Why don't I just wait and see what happens? Simply because this is not my patient. I'm covering the patient for somebody else.
And this, Jaina says, brings us to the less is more dictum in medicine, which, he notes, is not universally embraced.
The perception of healthcare is that by doing more, we can improve health. And what we need to recognize is that so much of healthcare, so many of the clinical decisions that we make operate in this gray zone. It's not black and white. And it could very well be the case that in the gray, less may be more.
Could it be that, you know, the doctors who are most likely to attend these conferences are those who are involved in research, and that they perhaps aren't as good at clinical care, and the ones who are left behind are maybe better. Is that a possible explanation?
That's a possible explanation. I think the reason that we find our results predominantly in teaching hospitals is because if you look at the fraction of academic cardiologists who attend these meetings and you look at the fraction of community cardiologists who attend these meetings, I think the share would be larger among academic cardiologists. We haven't been able to get any great data from the American College of Cardiology or American Heart Association, but whatever data they do publish online would support that. And so that's why it's not surprising that we saw the effects there.
I'm curious, Dr. Jaina, have you heard from either the American Heart Association or the American College of Cardiology, the two conferences that you measured?
Not formally. I think the American College of Cardiology released a statement which is very well worded. It basically said it's reassuring to know that during dates of national cardiology conferences, our patients receive no worse care, which is technically true.
Technically true. But I could see this being, I could see them playing it either way. They could take it as an indictment that they are, you know, they represent a bunch of people who don't contribute to better care. On the other hand, they could say, hey, you know, our conference is a major lifesaver. We draw away all these people who are doing too many procedures, and that's saving a lot of lives. So, but I can't imagine they'll turn that into their slogan, would you?
Exactly, yeah. I've tried to advocate that to my own chair to let me go to more conferences, but that hasn't worked.
We did ask the two organizations to respond to Jaina's study. Richard Chazal is the ACC's vice president and a practicing cardiologist.
I think many of us were reassured that there wasn't an increase in risk during those meetings because many people had hypothesized that that might be the case, that when there was a departure of some physicians, that the staffing levels could result in an increased risk. So I do think it's reassuring to the public and to you and to me that we can safely get our care at a teaching hospital during periods of time of meetings. So that part is encouraging.
Pretty much as expected. Dr. Chazal did add this, however.
This is important and interesting information. The biggest concern here, and the one that we have to look at, is this finding and to try and tease out, if we can in the future, why that is and how we modify our behaviors so that we have a lower risk at all times.
The American Heart Association, meanwhile, sent us a recorded response from its president, Dr. Elliot Antman. We weren't allowed to interview him. Dr. Antman says there is no evidence of cause and effect in Jaina's study, and that we should essentially think of it as a calendar analysis.
So the investigators happened to analyze the period of time when cardiology meetings were occurring. They could have picked Christmas. They could have picked New Year's or Easter. We know that there are changes in the staffing schedule when there are holidays, when there are important national cardiology meetings. Bottom line for us at the American Heart Association, there's nothing in this study that we see that would lead us to recommend a change in clinical practice.
In my interview with Jaina, I had raised the same point. You might hear some snowplows going past in the background. There had been a big snowstorm in Boston when we talked. Okay, is it possible that these cardiology conferences are perhaps typically held at the same time of year every year, which might be a time of the year that coincides with lower mortality?
That's definitely possible, but you know, as it turns out, over the nearly 10 years that we looked at the data, the cardiology conferences actually varied in their time. So it wasn't that they were always at the same time in the year. They actually do vary slightly from week to week across the 10 years.
Right. I'm curious, has there been any similar research with psychologists or other mental health professionals? I'm wondering if anyone's ever looked at suicide and or hospitalization or even depression outbreaks, if such a thing can be measured during psychiatric conferences or maybe even just during August when all the shrinks in New York go to Cape Cod.
No, that's a great question. I'm not aware of any, and I actually looked into this to see whether or not there was anything that was done. It's something that we're going to do if it hasn't been done after exhaustive search. But it's a great example. I'll give you another example of something that we have actually looked at, which we do know data about, and I'm sure you've heard about it, is this July effect. It's the idea that patients who are hospitalized in academic medical centers in July have worse outcomes because the residents who are there are inexperienced. And by and large, what this literature has found is that the July effects, if they happen, are very small. And the question for clinicians was always, well, how is that possible? How is it possible that something that every clinician thinks to be a big issue turns out to not be a big issue when you look at the data? And what the insight that we had was that, you know what, every patient who comes in the hospital is different. And for most patients, it really does take a lot to lead to an adverse outcome. And so what happens if you focus on those patients who are the most sick? And what we did is look at the same kind of group of patients. We looked at patients who had heart attack who were in the top third of predicted mortality. And these patients have a mortality rate of about, as I said, 25 to 30%. And what you see is that for those patients, there actually is a July effect. So if you're hospitalized in a teaching hospital with a very severe heart attack, you are 5 percentage points more likely to die if you're hospitalized in July versus May. So basically 25% mortality versus 20% mortality. So it's a large effect. Of course, it goes in the opposite direction of what we're saying here in the sense that less is worse. But you know, that's one example of people looking at what happens around specific times of year or specific types of practices.
How do you account for that contradiction?
I think the contradiction is going to be what is the clinical decision that's being made. So I keep on coming back to this in my mind, like, why is this happening? And all I can come down to is I think that cardiologists are just making different clinical decisions during non-meeting dates. And I think the decision that's being made is this patient appropriate for a procedure? Because whenever you do something, you have to have in your mind, is this person good or bad for it? And let me give you another example. If a cardiologist had 100 procedures to allocate, and that's all they could do, I'm fairly confident that each one of the people that they allocated that 100 procedures to would do extraordinarily well. They'd have a beneficial outcome. But there's no constraint like that in reality. So you can go to the 101st, 102nd.
That's such an interesting way to think about it, and it makes me think that the economist part of your brain is intruding on the medical part of your brain there. And I wonder if you're leading to some kind of relationship between cost and treatment and availability and supply and demand and so on. So do you think that's, forget about just cardiology for a moment, do you think that's a major component of adverse outcomes that we're looking at generally, including just, you know, the fact that we spend more, a larger share of our GDP than any other country on earth, I believe, for healthcare, and yet our outcomes are super suboptimal. How much do you think that is due to a kind of endless, almost an endless supply and a relatedly very high demand?
You know, I think the common concern is that because doctors are paid fee for service, meaning they get paid for every procedure that they do, that it leads to over incentives for them to do procedures. I'm actually not convinced that that is really the root of all the quality problems that we find. My hunch is that the reason that physicians may be doing more procedures than is clinically optimal is that they just don't know any differently. Like, if you think about what is that impacts a physician's decision? Well, sure, what they get paid impacts it, just like it would impact anybody's decision. But what about where they went to medical school, what they learned during residency, whether or not they've been sued before, and most importantly, what is their level of risk aversion? I've got to imagine that that would translate somehow into clinical practice. I think that there are underlying differences in how people think, how cardiologists, how doctors think, that drive these decisions.
Ah, now we are entering a slightly different realm, what's generally called evidence-based medicine. We will get into that after the break.
What I think many people would be shocked to find out is that many of the things that we do in day-to-day care actually have very little evidence for them.
But we are getting better, aren't we?
We have a really deep problem with how we're training doctors. They are not being trained to be critical thinkers.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. But before we take the break, let's hear what some practicing cardiologists had to say about Anupam Jaina's paper, which was published in the JAMA journal Internal Medicine. we sent a producer to the annual meeting of the American College of Cardiology, or ACC, in San Diego. That is one of the two big annual conferences that Jane analyzed. The first thing we wanted to know is what kind of impression the paper has made.
Have you heard of this study?
No, I haven't. But I don't really think that it might affect the mortality of the patients while they're away, because normally in the hospitals there are plans to cover for this for the absence of the cardiologist.
I hope it's not affected at all, because before they leave, I'm sure they have somebody covering for them.
Right now my partners are covering for me while I'm out here, so I know my patients are getting excellent care and coverage while I'm not able to see them directly. I'm assuming that's the case for everybody.
What would you say if I told you the study found that there are actually less deaths during the conference? So the mortality rate improved while everyone was away.
That is very surprising, actually.
I wouldn't expect that mortality is lower. I would expect that when everybody is working at the hospital, the quality of care is better. That's the normal thing.
You should think the opposite, right? You should think the less doctors, the more dies, right? But it's interesting.
Well, we would have to look at the methods of the study to see how robust it is.
It just doesn't make sense to me that less access to a physician or less access to medical care would make things better. Now, having reviewed the study and the methodology, results from studies like this have to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, just because you have an association, as scientists, we all know that does not mean there's causation.
I have heard of the study, sort of a running joke in the department that they should, you know, pay more money to send us to conferences to improve outcomes in our hospital. But yeah, if you had asked me before, I wouldn't have guessed that would sort of be the result. I probably would have guessed there's no difference. And, you know, it just makes us wonder because if you're the person sort of left over when everyone else is at the conference, it's a time when, you know, there's fewer tests that can be done, people aren't available, it takes longer to get things done, and makes us wonder a little bit if it's a little bit better sometimes not to have easy access to all the technology right away. Sometimes it might be better to sort of slow things down and sort of see how they evolve.
Sometimes in the cardiology field, the intensity of care can be aggressive. And maybe sometimes some procedures are done without being strictly necessary.
It is very interesting that the quality improved and the mortality went down. So maybe they need to stay at the ACC in San Diego.
Check, check. So if I could start with your name, your title, and where you practice.
My name is Ariel Pimentel, and I'm a cardiologist, and I practice in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic.
My name is Kadir Osman. I'm an interventional cardiologist in Yuma, Arizona.
I'm Lynn Panus, assistant professor of medicine at Temple University.
My name is Pablo Toro. I'm coming from Honduras, Central America, and I'm internal medicine practitioner.
Mary Gleva, I am an associate professor of medicine at Washington University in St. Louis, and I'm an electrophysiologist.
Victor Mejia, practice in Louisiana, a cardiologist.
Pierangelo Ranella, pediatric cardiologist out of Orange County and at UCLA.
I'm Victor Soukalos. I'm an attending cardiologist at the University of Virginia.
If you want to hear more of Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On last week's show, we heard from Jeffrey Brenner. He's an MD in Camden, New Jersey, one of the poorest cities in the U.S. He's a family doctor.
So I see kids, adults, and deliver babies.
Brenner also founded the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers, It works with low-income patients to coordinate their care among a network of medical and social service organizations. The coalition's overarching goal, Brenner says, is to improve care while also reducing costs. That sounds like an admirable goal. It also sounds like what should be a common goal within the healthcare profession. Is it, in fact, a common goal to deliver healthcare for less money?
Not at all. The major imperative for most organizations in healthcare is to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And money is like fertilizer. And the way you get bigger is getting more money, more market share, more customers.
Brenner believes that the practice of medicine has been subsumed by the business of medicine. The activities that are incentivized, he believes, aren't necessarily good medicine. And this doesn't leave much room for doing something as basic and helpful as a doctor sitting down and talking with patients.
That's why I went into family medicine. I love to get to know my patients and talk with them. And I've always felt that the trick to healing and the trick to wellness and to change, like changing behavior, is relationship building and having a trusting relationship with someone who walks through the journey of life with you and helps nudge you in various directions. And that requires, you know, really talking with people.
But the current healthcare business model discourages that, Brenner says.
In our system, we have an asymmetry in price. So we pay a whole lot of money if you cut, scan, and hospitalize patients. If they have procedures, if they go through machines, we pay an enormous amount of money for those things. If you talk to a patient, you actually lose money in many instances. So when a cardiologist walks in the room and talks to your family member, that's actually a loss leader. That doctor is losing money every moment they stay in the room with your family member. The way they make money is by getting you out of that room back into the scanner that they're leasing in the back of the office. That's not their fault. That's the fault of how we've structured the incentives in the system.
Spending time talking with patients might just seem like a feel-good connection, but Brenner says it provides real benefits that aren't currently factored into the system.
We know that lots of people walk out of doctor's offices every day in America and really have no idea what the doctor said to them. We know that we have lots of safety errors. We have a lot of medication confusion. And I would argue a lot of those things are tied to communication as well. We know that in Medicare, that 25% of Medicare recipients are readmitted within 30 days. I would say a part of that is communication failure, that oftentimes when patients leave the hospital, they have very little understanding of what physicians said to them.
Brenner is a proponent of what's known as evidence-based medicine. Like Anupam Jaina, who found that cardiologists' absence leads to lower mortality, Brenner believes that a wise use of big data can lead to massive improvements in healthcare delivery, but that we aren't there yet. We aren't even close to there yet.
And what I think many people would be shocked to find out is that many of the things that we do in day-to-day care actually have very little evidence for them. They are habit that has been passed down from one generation to the next, but doesn't have literature backing it up. Building out research literature in medicine is expensive, it's complicated, it's difficult. Even once you've got the literature built out, moving that literature into practice can take 10 to 15 years. There is so much information overload now that doctors have a hard time even keeping up with all the evidence. So, you know, we have both a problem generating enough evidence and funding that, and then we have a metadata problem of how do we synthesize all the evidence and make sure that it's available to doctors every day when they need it.
I've always wondered, do you think that the reluctance to pursue evidence, to gather data in the realm of medicine, is in part because the history of medicine and the history of becoming a doctor encourages doctors to think of themselves as not necessarily godlike, but somewhere between humans and God, and that the evidence can be an implicit challenge to their wisdom, authority, intuition, and so on?
I think what you're describing is absolutely correct. I think there's even a deeper problem, which is that medical training bypassed the Enlightenment almost altogether. So if you look back in the roots of medicine as training, as a pedagogy, it goes back to Greek tradition. And in that Greek tradition, It was a lot of memorization, and it was fealty to authority. It was a tradition that was passed down through the generations. It was almost like a priesthood. And med school is really being inducted into a priesthood of power, money, and influence. And the Enlightenment was really about self-critical thinking and about, you know, use of rational thought and the scientific method to prove and disprove things in an objective way. And very few physicians really understand the scientific method. So you don't necessarily have to have a science degree to go to med school. And when you're in med school, most of med school is just memorization. So, you know, if you look at how medicine is taught, the first 2 years are mostly memorization. And then the second 2 years are rounding on patients with senior physicians in a very steep hierarchy where you learn to do what you're told and you don't challenge or embarrass the senior physicians.
So it sounds like what you're describing is a situation wherein in healthcare or in healthcare delivery, you've got the potential generation of millions, billions, trillions of data points because there are a lot of inputs and a lot of outputs. And yet it sounds as though most of the practitioners within that scenario aren't really that either concerned with or attuned to or at least practiced in the assimilation of all that data and what it can tell us, yes?
I think that's very true. And they're not trained in critical thinking skills that would enable you to pull that evidence apart, nor are they trained in now a very deep literature in psychology about how distorted evidence can be when you explain it to people around all of the implicit biases that you can set up in decision making. So, you know, I think that you would not only want to train people in how to interpret evidence, but then you would also want to train people in the communication skills necessary to describe risk to patients. Many of these discussions really revolve around helping patients understand risk. And those are very hard concepts to explain. There are tremendous ways that doctors can bias those conversations. And we don't do a good job of that. Nor are we paid in a way that would even encourage you to have those conversations.
Can you give an example of that kind of conversation where you're trying to deliver a message and how it can be misinterpreted or just not heard?
So my favorite example recently is about mammograms. So for women 40 to 50, mammograms do not save lives. Boy, that's a staggering thing to say. You know, we have been told as a society that go get your mammogram, it'll save your life. And our best statistical evidence is that mammograms 40 to 50 will not save your life and actually could cause you harm. Well, there were plenty of individual anecdotes that may say otherwise, but it's likely that the cancers that were discovered for people 40 to 50 will regress on their own and are not life-threatening cancers. Well, that's a really hard idea to get your head around. So, you know, you have some ridiculous statements by physicians in the media that really show a misunderstanding of how to interpret statistics and data, which I think are frightening. I mean, you know, it's not that different than doctors 200 years ago deflending bloodletting. And then 100 years later, the biggest argument in Europe was whether or not to wash your hands. And the leading cause of death in Europe was infection during childbirth. And it took 100 years to get doctors to wash their hands based on evidence. You know, then we turn the clock even further forward. You know, we hurt a lot of people with thalidomide. We hurt people with calcium channel blockers. We hurt people with inappropriate use of arthroscopy, of angioplasty. We're still hurting people today by using treatments that are not evidence-based and that are not statistically valid treatments for which we have literature that they shouldn't be using these treatments. So, you know, we have a really deep problem with how we're training doctors. They are not being trained to be critical thinkers. You know, I'm a huge student of medical history, and when you read medical history, it's very humbling. We have screwed stuff up and hurt people over and over and over, and we've done it with our arrogance. So, you know, I think, you know, we're still doing it, unfortunately.
So economists, healthcare economists particularly, would say, you know, a lot of the problems with healthcare and healthcare delivery is created by inefficiencies and in the market. And if you just let the market work the way the market should work, then things would get better and things would get cheaper. Do you agree? Is that a solution, or is that not the solution to the problem as it now stands?
I think it's a very idealistic solution, but you know, the ultimate market inefficiencies are created by asymmetries of knowledge, where the customer doesn't have perfect knowledge about what they're buying. Either they don't have price knowledge or they don't have knowledge about the product. The irrational marketplace of healthcare put me out of business. So I was happily going to work every day, taking care of poor people in Camden, had a small 3-exam room office, and loved my job and loved my office. And my office is currently boarded up and closed. And it's closed because the market didn't work. The Medicaid rates kept dropping in New Jersey. And by the time I was closed, I was getting sometimes $19 to $35 per visit. And it's impossible to keep the lights on and pay the overhead. So, you know, the irrational marketplace of healthcare didn't work.
That is, it didn't work for him. Big hospitals, meanwhile, get bigger. And with that supply, Brenner says, comes demand.
One of the problems is that we have a giant economic bubble underlying this, where we have hospital financing authorities underpinning that are run by states that help hospitals float bonds. And we have this giant bond market called the hospital bond market that's considered very secure, very safe, good investment. And, you know, that bond market has floated too much hospital capacity and created and brought online too many hospital beds, far more hospital beds than we need in America. So, you know, the most dangerous thing in America is an empty hospital bed. In the center of New Jersey, near Princeton, a couple of years ago, we built two brand new hospitals. These are two $1 billion hospitals, 10 miles apart, very close to Princeton. So one is called Capital Health and the other is Princeton Medical Center. I don't remember anyone in New Jersey voting to build two brand new hospitals, but we are all going to be paying for that the rest of our lives. We'll pay for it in increased rates for health insurance. And boy, you better worry if you go to one of those emergency rooms, because the chances of being admitted to the hospital when there are empty beds upstairs that they need to fill are going to be much, much higher than when all the beds are full, whether there's medical necessity or you need it or not. So I'd be very worried if you live in Princeton that there are now two $1 billion hospitals waiting to be filled by you.
But a system like this one, Jeffrey Brenner argues, is unsustainable. Or maybe we should say he hopes it's unsustainable.
There comes a point in a democracy when the public's had enough and they stand up and they get upset. And, you know, the baby boomers shifted every public system they've ever touched. They shifted schools, colleges and universities. They changed the institution of marriage, of child rearing, of employment. I think that they're probably going to change the institution of aging, medical care and dying ultimately. And I think you're starting to see, you know, lots of dialogue emerging about how people want to die. It would not take very much change in taste and preference to collapse the system. It's become so brittle and so overwrought and so overbonded and so overcapacity that the next great American bailout could be our academic health centers, our research centers, with a small cut in NIH funds, a small cut in Medicare payments, a small cut in the subsidies for training doctors, in what are called DSH payments. It would not take much to collapse academic health centers. And then as a society, we'd need to ask, do we want to bail them out? Are we getting our money's worth?
The humanist in me, and just the plain old human in me, agrees with you entirely about the desire and need to change and or collapse the current model. On the other hand, our healthcare spending is something close to, I believe, 20% of GDP now. Is that right?
Yep.
And I just look at that, and I look at it as if it's a mafia of some kind that's got a stranglehold, that's got so much money flowing from so many different directions with so many different avenues of revenue, many of which are, as you've pointed out, counterproductive and maybe even dangerous. And maybe I just don't have the imagination to envision what kind of public response to that would collapse a system with so much at stake. Can you just tell me how to get that picture in my mind?
So no one in the CIA could imagine Mubarak ever being out of power, right? You know, complex adaptive systems go through state changes, and they do it in very complex and unpredictable ways, where one day they're one way, and the next day there's been a dramatic shift. And, you know, the way that you undermine a complex adaptive system is you begin to undermine the inputs that sustain it. So the inputs that sustain complex adaptive systems are energy, money, goodwill, and, you know, I think the healthcare system's doing a very good job of eroding all those things. You know, I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but it's a very brittle system. It's a very leveraged system. It's hurting more and more people, not through, I don't think, an act of commission, but an act of omission. It's just its own complexity now is injuring people. The number of times I've been behind the scenes in a legislator's office and this heartrending story pours out of them about their own parents. You know, as the baby boomers are aging and people in their 40s are caring for their parents and watching what the system does to them, I think there's going to be a growing anger. You know, as the copays and deductibles and employee contributions get higher and higher, I think the goodwill underpinning the system is going to begin to break down. You know, there comes a point in a system in America where it no longer serves any of the purposes that it was originally set up to serve. And America does disrupt things. You know, I don't see a lot of horse and buggy manufacturers. I don't see the steel industry here, right? You know, no one saved Blockbuster. I mean, there will come a point when, you know, sooner or later, we're going to let this thing go.
Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, we try to answer a listener's question. What's the most efficient way to exercise? Unfortunately, the answer is not what I thought it might be, listening to public radio, but believe me, that's important too.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We love it when you send us your questions like, hey, Freakonomics, what's the best way to do this or that? Or, hey, Freakonomics, what's the story with such and such? Some of you are so smart, I'm not even sure you're real.
Hey, Freakonomics, this is Jasmine.
All right, hey, Jasmine, what would you like to know today?
I want to know, what is the best, most efficient form of exercise? I want to get the most benefit for the least amount of time invested. I don't have that much money, either. Also, I am kind of lazy. Thanks, Freakonomics.
All right, Jasmine, let's see if we can answer your question. The best, most efficient form of exercise. But let's start by examining the premise. Maybe you don't even need to exercise. Is exercise really as worthwhile as we think? So we put this question to David Meltzer. He's our kind of guy. He's a doctor and an economist at the University of Chicago.
I think there's a lot of good evidence, both observational as well as experimental, that exercise really helps. The numbers I often cite are that even something as simple as walking for half an hour a day, 5 days a week, raises your life expectancy by a year and a half. And exercising more intensively than that on a daily basis can produce gains that are double that.
No offense, Freakonomics, but I could have told you that exercise is good for me.
All right, I just want to make sure you're not wasting what little time you have. So as it turns out, Jasmine, your situation is pretty typical. Here's Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the phys ed column for the New York Times.
The most common reason that people give for not exercising is that they don't have time.
And here's what that means.
Most Americans are not exercising. The best statistics suggest that at least 80% of Americans are not meeting the most commonly used guidelines for exercise, which are those from the American College of Sports Medicine. And they suggest 30 minutes of moderate exercise most days of the week. The vast majority of Americans are not doing that.
Oh, now I don't feel quite so bad.
All right, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to exercise. So we took your question, what is the most efficient form of exercise? And we asked some people that we thought could answer it. Here's one of them.
The right way to think about this is it's the wrong question. And, you know, if I've learned anything in my life, whenever I ask the wrong question, it almost guarantees I will not find the right answer.
Ew, what a meanie. Who's this guy?
His name is Peter Attia. He's an MD and a nutrition expert and a fitness fanatic himself. Emphasis on the fanatic. Part of his exercise routine is flipping a tractor tire.
It's a pretty heavy tire. It's about 450 pounds. You're never actually lifting the entire thing at once because you're flipping it. I have a goal that I'm working really hard, mostly for fun, to get to, which is to break 16 seconds on six flips of that tire.
And here's why Dr. Attia thinks that this question, what is the most efficient form of exercise, is the wrong question.
If someone says to me, because I get asked this question all the time, what's the least I can do for the most? I really ask the person, what is it you want? What's your desired outcome? And it can be anything from, you know, I want to run my first marathon in 6 months, or I want to compete in a triathlon and it'll be my very first one, or I want to take my game to the highest level because I've already been doing this for a while, but I want to get a little bit better. It can also be something like I want to look better in a bathing suit, or I want to not get tired when I play with my kids. Those are all actually really elaborate physical activities.
Okay, so Jasmine, what is your exercise goal? Do you want to compete in a triathlon? Want to just look better in a bathing suit?
Oh, I already look very good in a bathing suit. This is mostly for my heart, for my longevity.
Well, if you're thinking longevity, there's one exercise that Gretchen Reynolds really likes, the squat.
The squat will use almost all of the biggest muscles in your body. Those in your upper legs, your back, your core. Those are also the muscles that you need to do things like get up out of a chair, which may sound facetious, but in fact, as you age, one of the best indicators of whether you will be independent well into your twilight years is if you can get up out of a chair and if you can go up and down stairs.
That sounds pretty good. But how am I supposed to know what exercises do the most good?
Okay, so let's talk about how exercise is actually measured. Here's David Meltzer again.
So the technical answer is exercise is probably best measured in terms of the total number of calories that you burn, and therefore the efficiency of exercise in terms of calories burned per unit of time is commonly measured in something called the metabolic equivalence score, or METS. And they rank all the exercises that you could imagine doing from the most intensive to the least intensive. And the scale starts at one, and one is basically rest. And in the sort of standard scales I've seen, the things that are right up at the top are basically running, soccer, which presumably means, you know, running all the time, I guess, unless you're the goalie. And then it works its way down. So things like running are a 10, jogging is a 7, golf is a 4.5. Then, you know, rest is a 1. But it's interesting because there are also some activities on the list that are things that you might have to do anyway, like yard work. And that's a 6.
Ew, I don't really like yard work. Is there anything else like that on his list that is a 5 or a 6 on the METS scale?
Well, square dancing is pretty good. And here I'll quote from a list put out by the Centers for Disease Control. Playing guitar or drums in a rock band, or fishing while walking along a riverbank. Any of that sound good?
I am not into fishing.
Sorry?
I am not into fishing.
All right, let's see what else. Clogging is good. Jumping jacks. Digging ditches.
Yeah, let me think those over.
Fair enough. Okay, so you could try an exercise commitment device, like joining a gym. Problem is, research shows that people who buy an annual gym membership overestimate how much they'll use it by about 70%.
What a waste of money.
Agreed. Now, there's another kind of commitment device, an app called Gym Pact, where you sign up for a certain amount of exercise, and if you don't follow through, you have to pay them.
I don't like that one bit.
All right, Jasmine, I hear you. So you want the best, most efficient, most cost-effective exercise you can find. Based on what our three wise guests have figured out over time, let me offer you a little checklist. We'll call it the three I's, okay? The first I, intensity. Here's Gretchen Reynolds again.
And that means simply that you go very, very hard for a brief period of time, and usually that you then have a short break and you go very, very hard again. There are a number of studies that have looked at different forms of high-intensity interval training and have found that, for instance, you can do 1 minute of, say, hard bicycling and 1 minute of much easier bicycling. And if you do 10 of those intervals, you get essentially the same physiological changes within your body as if you do about 90 minutes or 2 hours even of more common endurance training where you just go ride. It seems very clear that these intense bouts of exercise can improve your fitness and also improve your health just as much as much longer bouts, but they have to be hard. They have to hurt.
Jasmine, are you ready for the pain?
Maybe. Maybe not. What is the second I in your checklist of three I's?
Individualization. Here's Peter Attia again. He's the tractor tire flipping doctor nutritionist.
Kind of means using yourself as a guinea pig. You know, there's a lot of questions that I think we wish science would answer, but sometimes they're either not deemed a high enough priority in the scientific community, or the scientific experiments that are carried out are done on such a heterogeneous population that you can't necessarily extrapolate for yourself. And so one of the other things I do when I work with people is we really sort of embrace this concept of self-experimentation. Because at the end of the day, if I was working with you, it's really not that important what works for the population. It's really more important what works for you personally.
Okay, he doesn't sound so mean anymore.
Agreed. And that leads us to the last I on the exercise checklist. If the first two are intensity and individualization, the third one is I like to do it. Peter Attia, Gretchen Reynolds, David Melcher, they all agree that the best exercise is whichever one you'll actually do.
Whatever you will do is certainly the best exercise.
Well, what do you actually like doing?
Do something that you actually enjoy. Do something that makes you better.
So what do you say, Jasmine? Does that give you any ideas?
I do have something in mind, but I would rather not say.
Okay, no problem. But if whatever you are thinking about doing doesn't work out, we've got one more option for you. David Melcher told us about the ROM workout machine from a company called Quick Gym.
The best exercise machine is the one you'll actually use. And the one that gives you a total body workout in only 4 minutes is the one you'll use every day.
So you sound to me like the kind of person who could really warm up to this machine, Jasmine. But let me warn you, it costs more than $14,000.
Ouch. Is it worth it?
Well, it depends who you ask. Here's how David Melcher sees it. Now remember, when he's not busy being a doctor, he's being an economist.
Yeah, well, I guess the economic logic of it is that it doesn't require very much time at all to get a full day's workout. So presumably, if you know it took an hour to get a comparable workout, and it only takes you 4 minutes, it saved you 56 minutes. So presumably, you know, that's worth your hourly wage, you know, five times a week over a year. You can price that out and amortize it, and, you know, that's probably worth quite a lot of money. Maybe you'll even get a new sponsor for the show.
With the ROM, there's no time to get bored. By the time you think of an excuse, 4 minutes is up and you're getting on with your day.
Hey, Freakonomics, that's pretty neat. Thank you for your help.
Thanks for the question, Jasmine. Looking forward to the next one. And if you have a question, drop us an email at radio@freakonomics.com. You can also subscribe to our free weekly Freakonomics podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.